Welcome to MetaStrategy's Forum on World-Class IT. I'm Peter High, and I'm pleased to welcome Stuart Butterfield to the broadcast. Stuart is the founder and chief executive officer of Slack, the fastest-growing business app ever. It's a messaging and file-sharing application heralded as the email killer of the workplace, with over $100 million in annual revenue. As CEO, Stuart's responsible for all operations throughout the company, as well as defining the future vision of the company. Prior to Slack, Stuart co-founded the picture-sharing site Flickr, which was acquired by Yahoo in 2005. He continued as the general manager of Flickr at Yahoo until mid-2008. Stuart received his Bachelor of Philosophy degree from the University of Victoria and his Master of Philosophy degree from the University of Cambridge. I recently caught up with Stuart over the phone, and our conversation covered World-Class IT Principle 1, people, as we discussed the culture at Slack and how it impacts productivity. Principle 4, IT and business partnerships, as we discussed how Slack can facilitate discussion throughout various levels of a business. Principle 5, IT and business partnerships, as we discussed how Slack interfaces and partners with outside sources to drive their platform forward, as well as a variety of other topics. Stuart Butterfield, welcome to the Forum on World-Class IT.
Thank you so much, Peter.
Stuart, I thought we'd begin with kind of the beginning of Slack itself. It was the result of a pivot when you were running a company called Tiny Speck, and it was a component to a game called Glitch, as I understand it. Can you talk a little bit about the genesis of that, the original intent of it, and how this became the idea itself?
Sure. It actually wasn't part of the game, but a tool that we used internally to communicate. So the company was started by myself and three other members of the original Flickr team. At the time we started it, we had one person in New York, one person in San Francisco, and two in Vancouver, British Columbia. So the natural thing for us to use was IRC. And IRC, as you probably know, is now 27 years old, but predates the web by a couple of years. A pretty, by modern standards, clunky and ancient technology. So it has a bunch of deficiencies. For example, if you and I are using IRC to communicate and you're not connected to the server at a given moment, I just can't send you a message. So we built a system to log messages so people could catch up when they got back online. And once we had those messages in a database, we wanted to be able to search, so we added search, and then I could keep going for a very long time with the features we added. But I think one of the critical things was we were doing this in a really subconscious or preconscious way, not the normal method of software development. Like there's no ego and no speculation. It was just whenever a problem got so irritating that we couldn't stand it anymore, or whenever an opportunity for an improvement was so obvious that we couldn't help but take advantage of it, we would do that and then go back to what we were supposed to be working on. The result of that after 3.5 years or so was this system for internal communication that all of us agreed we would never work without again. And we decided to see what else was out there in the market, and there wasn't anything good. And so we made that a product at the moment we decided to shut down the game.
In those early days, what were the ambitions for it? Clearly, as you say, there was a need that wasn't being met, even after seeking out something that might be more readily available that you could simply use. How big was the ambition in those early days? There are so many different areas now that it covers, so many different products that it now and product categories that it now competes with. Did you see like a broader enterprise use in those early days? Did you see this as something that would be taking on the likes of, email as well as kind of like the Skypes of the world, if you will? How did that all occur to you, and how quickly did the broader implications of it sort of grow?
I think it was actually a little bit of a slow boil in terms of how big it could be. We had taken a bunch of venture capital funding, and when we decided to shut down the game, we had $5 million left. Investors didn't want their money back. They wanted us to try something else. So when we were putting together the kind of pitch deck for Slack and explaining what we were going to do, we had sized the market at $100 million in revenue. That's what we thought we could accomplish. And we blew past that this summer already. And that was kind of what we imagined as the end state of this whole enterprise. So it was turned out to be much bigger than we could have imagined at the time we started working on it. We were thinking more specifically for teams like us. So smaller work group scale, typically software development kind of organizations. And those were our very earliest customers. But it, 6 months or so in, the possibilities were more apparent. And the longer we go, the more we see the true nature of the size of the market and the more our ambition grows.
You mentioned that extraordinary revenue growth and beating sort of your end state revenue targets already. Aside from revenue growth or daily active users, what are some of the other kind of metrics you're using to gauge the health and momentum of the business as well as its broader influence?
Well, we have a lot of different metrics across the board. So not all of them are ones that we feel like we need to increase. So for example, across all daily active users, including people who are just getting started, people spend about 2.25 hours in active use with Slack each day. So 10 hours a day connected to the service. I'm connected right now, but not actually using it. But active use would include things like sending a message, changing channel, opening the app, uploading a file, commenting on a file. And that's a long time. And it might not be that we want to drive up the amount of time that people are spending using the app. It might be that we're actually better fulfilling our mission, which is to make people's working lives simpler, more pleasant, and more productive, if we reduce that number instead. You know, maybe it will be better if people are only spending an hour and 45 minutes a day. But we look at things like Net Promoter Score, NPS. We look at customer satisfaction scores on our responses to customer support inquiries. That's something that's really important to us. Things like the time to first response, service availability. We like to look pretty broadly across all points of customer contact and anything we can measure about the service.
You mentioned that in the early stages, you were building it for companies like your own. So as you saw needs that applied to your own organization, by extension, you were serving those companies that were in some ways size-wise or growth-wise, not unlike Slack itself. I know now there's increased emphasis and, in fact, increased adoption among larger enterprises. What are some of the ways in which you are changing the offering or adding different aspects to it in order to cater to the needs of an enterprise that's, 1,000 or 10,000 or 100,000 folks instead of, 5, 10, 20, 100?
So there's a couple aspects to that. One is compliance or features that are required as part of someone's regulatory environment. And that would be things like digital loss prevention or e-discovery, message retention settings, a certain set of security features. So there's those that are kind of checklist requirements. And then there's another set that are more about how do you actually interact with people at that scale? Because you can have a very different relationship with the group of people that you most immediately work with towards some common goal, like your primary team, which might be 5 people, it might be 30 people. In some cases, it might be 80 people or something like that. But 10,000 people, 50,000 people, 100,000 people, that's never one team except in some metaphorical sense. And so we looked really hard at how Slack was used by larger and larger groups. So 1,000 customers, 2,000, 5,000. We actually sent our user research team out to go sit with the customers for periods of time and get some insight on how it was working. We also get tens of thousands of points of contact via Twitter and our customer support ticketing system every month and can kind of synthesize those results. So where we ended up with on the enterprise product is something that's a little bit more like a team of teams approach to workplace communication. So there's one, in some sense, simpler, more horizontal version of Slack that provides identity and direct messaging across the whole enterprise. But then there's an unlimited number of teams with an unlimited number of shared channels across those teams, and people can be members of more than one team. So, but choose a random employee. Let's say it's Amy. She has the team that corresponds to her business unit. She also works in marketing. So there's a global marketing team that she's a part of, and she works in the Dallas office. And so she's part of the Dallas office team. And there might be others that are based either on communities of practice or employee resource groups. but you'll have these kinds of views on the organization. At the same time, there can be shared channels that are organization-wide, and she has the ability to communicate in a direct message context with anyone across the organization. So it took us a while to get to whether we just wanted a version of Slack that scaled to a larger and larger number of participants or something slightly different. And then we ended up with something slightly different.
It's been said that Slack is becoming the operating system of the office. I wonder if that's a moniker that you accept, and if so, kind of what that entails from your perspective.
Yeah, I think we struggle with what the right terminology is. And, you know, internally, we sometimes say like a nervous system or connective tissue or the internal network. Operating system is an interesting one, though. I mean, obviously, we don't do things like control file input and output and disk arrays and network cards and stuff like that. But as those technologies increasingly stabilize and become commodified, the real operating system to a certain extent is up the stack. And it's about connecting people to each other, but also people to the applications that they use and the workflows, business processes, and even those external systems one to another. So we look at our own usage of Slack, and obviously we're heavy users of our own product. We have a little over 600 employees. We send something like 100,000 messages a day between people, but triple or quadruple or, you know, even 5x or more that number of messages, so 500,000 messages a day that are from external systems. And I mean things like every time we get a customer support ticket, every time someone tweets at us, every time we make a sale, every time a new account is assigned to an account manager, every database alert, every time we deploy new code, every run of our stat server analytics, all of that stuff flows into Slack and becomes searchable and accessible to a much larger number of people than it would otherwise be available to. And we're simultaneously seeing people build entirely new kinds of applications on top of Slack that either wouldn't have been possible in any other context or, you know, while they were technically possible, would never have been used by anyone. And when I say that, I mean things like workflows for things like expense approvals or time off requests being routed through Slack at the kind of the simple end, but also new breed of performance feedback tools and employee engagement tools that are that kind of live in that messaging environment. And you're prompted to give feedback on peers' performance throughout the course of the year. So when November or January or whatever time the annual performance review at your company happens, rolls around, by the time that rolls around, you have this extensive notes that were less painful to develop and are also going to be much more accurate because they're not as shaped or colored by the most recent interaction you've had with someone, but were taken over the course of the year. We see people building bots for things like project management, doing the daily stand-up meetings and coordinating those, kind of running different bits of coordination. And that's really exciting. I think there's a big future for those kinds of applications.
You referenced the fact that part of what makes Slack effective is the ecosystem that you're building. And between like the App Directory, even Slack Fund, which I'd love to talk a little bit about separately, you have a very active developer ecosystem. I wonder sort of how you think about that, how you think about developing that and the advantages you've garnered by making it so easy for others to develop on top of it or partner within Slack.
Yes, if you go back to the origins, when we first started using the IRC-based kind of proto Slack system years before we actually thought about Slack as an independent product, we noticed this interesting phenomenon where the more people paid attention to that internal tool, the more information we routed into it. And the more information we routed into it, the more people paid attention to it. So there's this virtuous cycle. And when I say routing information, I mean things like when someone uploaded a file to the file server, that would get announced into IRC. Or when there was a problem with the database, that page or alert would go into IRC. Or when our daily stats run completed, that would get posted into IRC. So there's always, you know, it always felt like there's something there around the power of those integrations. And one thing that was clear from the beginning of the time that we started to think about this as a product is if Slack is the one application that everyone on the team has open all day, every day, it's the perfect place to surface applications which are either very occasionally used across the organization or which people otherwise wouldn't have access to. So just to unpack that a little bit, we, like many companies, use Concur for expense reporting. And that was a decision driven very much by finance. They're the people who really care about which tool we use because they have a handful of people who are heads down in that tool all day, every day. On the other hand, expense reporting is something from the perspective of an individual employee that happens once a month or once a quarter, very occasionally used. And rather than remember to go to an entirely distinct service, that's a great kind of process to initiate from inside of Slack, given that you're there, you know, and you have it open. Same thing with bug tracking. That was like for our own team, one of the very first things we did was integrate our bug tracking system into Slack so that you could create bugs from inside of Slack. And if you were a software engineer who dealt with the resolution of bugs or a project manager who was prioritizing them, you would go to the actual bug tracking tool and use those more complex interfaces. But for me, if I just wanted to report one, I would do /bug at the name of the person to whom I wanted to assign it, and then write out some text, hit enter. Then the bug gets created. It echoes the URL back to me. I can click that and then add more detail if I want to. And that reduction in friction, although it might not seem very great, led to a dramatic increase in the quality of the bugs reported and the number of bugs that were reported. So, you know, the alternative was leave Slack where we were having this discussion about the problem, go to a browser, open a new tab, start typing the URL of the bug tracker, wait till I had typed enough that it recognized it, hit enter, wait for that page to load, hit the new bug button, and then start typing. And just removing that, you know, whatever that is, 7 steps or something like that, meant that there was a lot more facility with it. It doesn't mean that we don't have a bug tracker. It doesn't mean we don't have an expense reporting system. So we're not trying to subsume all of those applications. We're trying to give another front end, another interface between those applications and the human beings who would use them that is, you know, either lives entirely within Slack or is initiated from within Slack.
Late last year, you started the Slack Fund, an investment fund in partnership with a number of venture capital firms as well. Can you talk a bit about the rationale for so doing and where you've been placing bets?
Yeah, so we heard from a lot of people that either they wanted to try a business idea that was, you know, Slack first in the sense that people would say mobile first, or relied on Slack for a chunk of its functionality. And because this was a brand new thing, it was perceived as more risky. So one of the things we wanted to do was encourage investment in this area and show people that we were serious about it and that we supported their efforts. Ideally, we also make money on those investments, but that's not the primary motivator. It's kind of to kickstart that ecosystem. And to that extent, we've been very successful. There's tens of thousands of unique paid customers using Slack, which is, from the perspective of a brand new startup, a huge number of potential customers for them. But even from the perspective of an established dominant player within an industry, it's a pretty lucrative group of people to get in front of. So we've seen partnerships with some of the largest companies in the world and integrations developed with their products that are available in the App Store. But we've also seen a large number of brand new products that principally reach their customers through Slack. At this point, I think we've done about a dozen investments. We have a full-time manager, and we're continuing to make more. Just over the last couple of weeks, I've seen 2 new deals proposed.
Very interesting. You, Stuart, have been an entrepreneur several times over. You've founded or co-founded a number of companies prior to Slack, including Flickr, for instance, perhaps most prominently. I'm wondering, as somebody who is a serial entrepreneur, who were some of the people who were particularly important mentors or people of influence to you as you were rising in your business career?
There's been so many, and some of them have just been people who have the strength that I traditionally have lacked. So people management, when I first got started, I was a very capable leader, but a pretty lousy manager. And I remember working with a guy named Andrew Bracha at Yahoo, and Yahoo was the company that bought Flickr. And everyone on his team was like really hardworking and reliable, did what they said they were going to do, really on top of everything, and seemed to be operating at this level of productivity and effectiveness that I found difficult to manage to. And I asked him, how do you find such good people? Because at that time, I was really struggling to manage a group of about 50 people. This person wants a promotion. That person doesn't like working with this person. There wasn't I felt a high degree of alignment, everyone working towards a common goal. So he said, I don't find any better people than you. I just fire people more quickly. And that was an eye opener for me, because I think we're very reluctant to move people out of an organization. And fire is kind of an overly aggressive or even ugly word. But there's definitely times when there's not a good fit between someone and the organization. Or there was at one time and the organization has evolved or grown to the point where it doesn't work anymore. And it's typically not because someone is stupid or lazy or incompetent. It's a lot more subtle than that, but to the extent to which people are kept around beyond the point where they really, where it's an effective working relationship, it can be really demoralizing to everyone else, and it can really impede progress. So I think that was an eye-opener for me to make sure it is the right group of people. And there's dozens and dozens more. You know, that was 10 years ago. More recently, a woman named Kim Scott, who's an engineer at Google and Apple and an engineering leader in those companies, and gave a talk called Radical Candor, which went viral a year ago and has started a company since called Candor, which is about giving effective feedback and management. So I feel like the business side came more naturally to me, and the product and design side was something that I was more comfortable with. But managing and effectively leading large organizations of people is something that is perpetually challenging and a topic on which I'm constantly looking for good advice.
Sticking with the people topic for a moment, Peter Drucker famously said that culture eats strategy for breakfast. I wonder if you could sort of describe the culture that you have shaped at Slack. What are some of the ways in which you would describe that?
First of all, I think it's very highly mission-driven. I mean, I think we do a good job in making that clear to candidates before they even start the process. The company's mission is to make people's working lives simpler, more pleasant, and more productive. And we like that because it doesn't have the kind of false grandiosity that you sometimes hear from Silicon Valley companies that has been lampooned in the TV show Silicon Valley. But it is also, you know, has a lot of ambition in it. We want to raise the productivity of the entire world of knowledge workers. And that's a pretty profound thing. So looking for people who share that mission and that would like to work within the set of values that we've identified. We're also trying to build a really high-performance organization. So that means one in which responsibility is taken, there is accountability for people's actions, and where candid and direct feedback is welcome. And that can be really tough. You know, if you look at a professional sports team, they will analyze the tape of the game and give feedback that is not meant to blame people for mistakes that they made or make them feel bad about them, but drive towards improvements the next time. And that's the kind of culture that we'd like to create, where we can look at things that we've done that have been successful or that have failed and learn from them and improve continuously. And that philosophy of continuous improvement is one that we take really seriously. And I absolutely agree with that sentiment from Drucker, because especially the position that we're in, we have really exceptional product market fit. People love to use it. We, as an enterprise software company, have grown tremendously on the basis of recommendation and customer love. We're in a good position vis-a-vis competition. We've landed in probably the most strategic area of enterprise software. I'd love to take credit for that as something that we thought about in advance, but we kind of just found ourselves there. So everything is going great. And the way that we can not succeed, you know, the way that we can fail to live up to the potential is unforced errors that are, we're growing incredibly quickly. Beginning of 2015, we had 80 people. By the end, we had 320. So that's 4x growth over the course of the year. And since then, so far this year, we've about doubled again. And, you know, you go to an all hands meeting and you ask people to put up their hands if they've been here for less than 6 months, you know, half of the company will put up its hand, more than half of the company. So you look inside of any given team, it's very frequent that you find half of the team is brand new, or sometimes even three quarters of the team. And that's obviously a big challenge to the cohesion and the ability to really execute at the highest level, because you have to establish some trust. You have to have some knowledge of your coworkers and your colleagues and figure out how to work most effectively together. And that's hard when the growth has been so rapid.
Do you worry at all about the watering down of talent? Surely there was a time not very long ago, in fact, where you were probably interviewing everyone who got a job at the organization. And obviously that's not feasible at the scale of hiring that's happening now. What are some of the ways in which you ensure that the 1,000th employee is of equal talent and merit to your 10th employee, say?
I think we have a pretty good process of that. We have an outstanding recruiting team, but also outstanding support from the hiring managers to be involved in the recruiting process. So even though I'm not there, there's a lot of good people and the standards are kept very high. But to be honest, you know, like I look at some of the best employees we have, and it's rarely because they have some special native ability, like they were born really good at arithmetic or something like that. But they are really good at elevating the people around them. They're really good to work with. They have low ego. They work hard. They're focused. They're not distracting people. They're supportive of their colleagues. And a lot of that stuff you can be trained for. So when people say talent, you know, like the thing that comes to mind is maybe how good you are at complex algorithms on the one hand, or, you know, it's an analogy to how high you can jump or how fast you can run. Whereas the element of teamwork, I think, is perhaps underappreciated, because you can take a team of absolute all-stars in terms of their native abilities. And if they're not working together, they're much, much less effective than a team where there's less native ability, but a higher degree of teamwork and cohesion. So it's whether or not the talent gets watered down in that sense of how well people score on aptitude tests or something like that. The lever that we have and the way that we can make sure that the company as a whole is still operating as effectively as possible is looking at that teamwork and how people work together, how clear communication is. You know, assuming that there's some baseline level of competence, if the goals and the priorities are really clear and there is some kind of structure or process for how decisions are made and how work gets done, then we should be able to operate at that highest level.
Well, Stuart Butterfield, thank you so much for joining us on the Forum on World Class IT. It's been a great conversation.